Rear Admiral Joe Vavadich is Assistant Commandant for Acquisition and Chief Acquisition Officer of the United States Coast Guard, part of the Department of Homeland Security. Admiral Joe, it's terrific to see you again. Thank you very much for coming in. First of all, congratulations on your promotion. Since the last time we spoke on the air, you have gained a promotion to CAO and Assistant Commandant for Acquisition. Tell me about the transition from your previous position. When we talked last, you were overseeing the Qatar program to what you're doing now. Thanks
Great.
For coming
well,
in, my friend.
One, thank you for having me here to be able to tell our story and where we are in Coast Guard acquisition programs. For me, it's somewhat of a fleet up. It's I'm doing my boss's job now, and so this model that we've had for about 8-10 years, where we bring a senior executive, a flag officer, into the program for 2 years to oversee essentially the programs, the projects that are delivering the capability, the national security cutter, the offshore patrol craft cutter, and then we do that for a couple years, and we fleet up to this larger chief acquisition role that encompasses something that's a little broader, also paying attention to the acquisition programs. But I have the head of contracting, the contracting activities under my purview right now, the R&D program under my purview, the international work that we have is in either the foreign military sales or the excess defense article. Those programs I get to oversee. Get to have a little bit more of a focused look in terms of the financial aspects that come with the acquisition. So it's forced me to look a little broader, more strategically, a little bit more outward, where before I would say that I got to really pay attention to cost schedule performance mm-hmm. with the program managers, roughly 20 of them, working with the senior captain 06s, GS-15s that we have that are actually project program managers that are running it. So it's a great way for the Coast Guard to keep a senior executive flag officer in program for 4 years. We've mm-hmm. been doing that for a while. Typically, what we'll see in the DOD side of the house, the Navy, the Army, when they're assigned PEOs or in charge of a particular acquisition program, they typically see it through a major decision acquisition decision event, mm-hmm. or they keep them around for four or 5 years, and that's kind of the lifetime that they have with the program. And so this we kind of balance it since we're a little smaller than the typical DOD agency.
Your previous position overseeing the Qatar program, how does the experience that you had there inform what you're doing now that you're overseeing three major domains in
right.
the acquisition shop?
So one is we get to take a broader view and understand the elements that we had before and maybe drive them in forward. So some of the stuff has been in play for a while. One of the things that when you reached out a month or so ago, I think you saw an article about the national security cutter mm-hmm. and earlier this year in the springtime, we just put on contract the number 8 on there, which is the program of record. Rarely do you get to see in the Beltway an agency achieve its program of record. So it was a pretty big milestone for us. But as we look in a rearview mirror, we look at programs like that, or which is really our open ocean deployer, 118-foot, very capable, sophisticated cutter. Another one that we're in the middle of acquisition is this fast response cutter, more of the patrol boat size of cutter we had. We just accepted the 14th one, program record of 58. And then we're working on the highest priority right now, the offshore patrol cutter right now. And so that's the kind of in between, again, open ocean, offshore persistent craft that can go out with the flight deck. And so what did we do in those other two programs that we can drive into the OPC? We're constantly challenged with affordability. We're constantly challenged about, do we have the right requirements? Are we producible, achievable? How are we engaging the industry? And, those are the kinds of things that I can now more pay attention to and make sure we're advocating and that we're truly on course to achieve that.
For programs like this, the word that you said there that I think is most significant is requirements, because we see this when the Navy's doing shipbuilding programs and we see it in other kinds of defense programs where requirements creep becomes the bugaboo of the program. What's your campaign against requirement creep in the Coast Guard?
We
look
did
like?
Touch on about that a little bit. And so even for the stability that we've had in the National Security Cutter program, right, mm-hmm. We're able to achieve that program of record because there's been no requirements creep. Essentially, as we produce these cutters roughly one a year. We just accepted our fifth one. We'll have the sixth one come out roughly a year or so, a little longer, at the end of next year. The seventh one a year after that. The eighth, which, again, we just put on contract another year or so after that. In terms of requirements, nothing's changed. I mean, the baseline, the configuration, some of those changes will be in there, but they're fact of life. There's obsolescence issues that we have to drive into it. But some of that we can forecast, we can predict. We have industry to help us understand what that looks like. And again, it just makes it a lot more stable, more predictable, even keeled, tempered, we're able to produce that. So we drive that in the other program. So again, when we look at the OPC program, we spent a lot of time on the requirements to make sure that there's just right. And so industry wants to know what we want and what we're going to buy. They don't want to guess. We spent a better part of 3 years really just focusing on that. So we started in the 2009 to 2000 timeframe with a whole bunch of one-on-one engagements with industry. We had other meetings where we had folks come out. We had draft RFP sections that we put out to industry. We had comments. And they had the opportunity to say, do you understand what you're asking here? Do you understand that's a cost driver? And so we had like 1,800 comments in that 3 year, and we drove about half of them into changes. Mm-hmm. And so we locked that down, and by the time we put that into an RFP in September 2012, it has been stable. Mm-hmm. And again, they've been able to work on that. Again, understanding that the future looks stable. We're seriously committed to that. Our operators are, again, stakeholders in that, our overseers. We're trying to get them to understand and have a stake in that as well. And again, if we want a producible, capable cutter that, again, we can predict what that looks like, both in cost, schedule, performance, you got to have stable requirements, Francis.
How much of what you did there do you think was acquisition, policy, process, procedure? And how much of it was just discipline and leadership? This is what we want. This is how we're going to build it. We're going to build all eight of these pretty much the same way.
And so the answer is yes, right? You can go back and search archives of lessons learned about why things, there were cost growths, why things fell apart on the schedules, because there wasn't a level of commitment from all the stakeholders. And again, we could talk about the operators, and then I also talk about the technical authorities, the one that owns the policy for naval engineering or C4IT or even training and human resourcing. All those folks need to be bought in terms of that requirement, keeping it stable to be able to achieve that program of record, again, in a predictable manner. Mm-hmm. And I would offer even our overseers, our folks in the department, our advocates up on the Hill, they typically do understand what we're going after, and they understand the importance of that. So it's in policy, because we typically want to go back and understand, make sure that what we buy, we understand what we're going to buy, and then at the end of the day, we're going to test to it. And again, as you move that cheese around, it gets convoluted and tricky over time. And mm-hmm. so if you can lock it down and keep it stable, I think it does keep things a lot more stable.
You mentioned overseers, and it strikes me that given the number of overseers that are interested in various pieces of the Homeland Security Department on the Hill, it's helpful to gain that stability every single point along the way whenever possible, so that you know the story is not going to be different 6 months from now when you go to this other committee than it was 6 months ago when you went to that one.
That's very true. And again, it's when we develop the need and we truly understand the need, we do that in a very open and inclusive group, right? And so it's not a small group that sits down there and says, I'm going to figure out the need, and when I'm done, I'm going to wrap it up and throw it over the transom. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, everyone understand and is bought in on what that means, because again, so we could have a piece in there and we could say, do you understand the training piece of that? Do you understand what the sustainment piece is going to be that? Do you understand? Is that? And then we get to challenge that as well from an acquisition viewpoint, because we hold each other, what I would call, accountable to what we have. And so at the end of the day, I would say at one point in time in our Coast Guard acquisition timeline, we thought we could just write a requirements document, put whatever we want into it, throw it over the transom, and let the other guy figure out how to achieve that. And of course, you know how hard that can get in terms of cost, schedule, performance.
Sure.
And so now we look at those cost drivers and we truly understand what the operator's asking for to make sure that it's going to have impact on mission. So I'll use the offshore patrol cutter as an example. We looked at the things that we have on the national security cutter and in the fast response cutter and making sure that we understood what might be cost drivers in that. And the, one of the things that we decided that we'd change to make sure that we drove as much affordability into the program is that we are not going to use a stern launch off of that. We're going to use the traditional davits to be able to deploy the cutters off of that. We looked at the size of the flight deck. And again, if you ask the operator, they want the biggest possible, most capable flight deck that they can possibly ask for. And we'd say, is that realistic? Because it'll drive cost to sustain, cost to build. And again, what are we going to use this for? Is it going to be an out-of-hemisphere deployer? Is it going to steam with the Navy? Does it really need that level of ballistic protection? You know, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, we look at the number of people, and we force that conversation. We own that. I mean, a lot of times, I think when we talk about affordability and acquisition programs, sometimes I think we push it out to industry, and we want them to figure out, hey, we have this great need. You come up with this great technological advantage. Figure out what that looks like and make sure that it's cheap as possible. We own that piece of it. You know, we get to decide what those are. I mean, we truly don't need the titanium pump. You know, we're good with your 101 off the shelf. If it fails, we'll just go buy another one and pop it in there.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I look at the scope of your portfolio. Aviation programs, surface programs, and C4ISR are the three main domains in the acquisition program at the Coast Guard. And I note from your bio that you have experience in a couple of cases, command experience in each of those areas. And a certification I see from the National Defense University, a CIO certificate that you hold. So you have the ability, it strikes me, to go into these programs and look at requirements from a position of experience and not just there's a guy over here telling me that it should be a certain way.
Right. So that's an interesting one that you picked up on, the CIO certificate. In the news, in the mandates, the cybersecurity, information assurance has certainly been part of the driver. Those are part of the requirements piece of it. And so maybe that experience has helped me have the dialogue to go to the CIO or the chief security officer to truly, again, we're requirements-based. We want to achieve that. And so if you look at maybe that aspect of it and they say, hey, I want a cybersecurity safe cutter. I don't want people hacking in. Well, what's the standard look like? What level are we trying to achieve? And so my job as an acquisition professional for my guys is that you want a certain level of performance or standard. My job is to tell you what that looks like in terms of, again, cost, schedule, performance. What does the infrastructure look like? What does the sustainment piece look like? What do the people take to be able to achieve that? And the other part is that we want to have all those conversations, what we say, to the left. As early as possible. Those kinds of things are not bolt on.
Mm-hmm.
We got to figure that out early and bake those kinds of things in. And so in terms of the cyber and the CIO piece, it's in all our conversations because you can't buy a car now. You can't even buy a blender that's not networked in somewhere along the way.
Yeah, so. We see the reports of a car that was hacked recently. I mean, fortunately, it was just for the sake of demonstrating that it was possible. But boy, the idea that everything that you're building, from helicopters to the computers that you install, the idea they're all going to be on the network must be a daunting cybersecurity challenge.
It's a team effort, mm-hmm. But I think it's necessary because at the beginning of the day and at the end of the day, we got to focus on mission. We got to focus on our people. And so, you know, if we're truly going to be able to leverage the best of technology and the best of people, there's capability out there that we need to be able to make it work. And will you be able to totally tighten down, put clamps on things to be determined? But, you know, my analogy is that, you know, you can put enough security on your house that you're going to lock yourself out.
Mm-hmm.
Or you put enough security in and you're just going to deter the kid around the corner. But on the other hand, if someone really wants in, and they have the resources. I mean, so that's the risk position, those conversations that we need to have as we figure out the security postures of our systems.
How has that risk management conversation changed in your view in the acquisition community over the past, say, year to 5 years?
It's broadened, that conversation. The appreciation has grown a lot more. It's probably become a little bit more personal to people, whether it's actually happened to them or not. Certainly the neighbor or the person in the news, people are saying, that could have been me, mm-hmm. or that could have been my agency, that could have been my car, my boat, my helicopter, whatever. And so, you know, it's given a little bit more pause and more credence, credibility when we bring that to the table. And so in that sense, it's helped, but it's still a hard problem, Francis. Mm-hmm. So
let's talk about each of those domains for a moment. And you can tell me some of the highlights of what you're working on at the Guard, the aviation portfolio first.
Right. So one of the new exciting things that we have is that we're taking on these C-27 airplanes built by Alenia. It started out as a joint Air Force-Army program as the joint cargo aircraft, I believe, in roughly the 2007 timeframe. And large contract with Alenia. They end up buying 21 of them, I believe. It flew a mission in Afghanistan. At some point, funding changed and they decommissioned them, or they stopped running and they put it all stop in 2012. They sent them out to Davis-Monthan Air Force Base, the mothball fleet, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, there's been some conversations that says that we could potentially use that. And so in the National Defense Authorization Act of 2014, it pointed and said, Coast Guard, you get to have those. And part of the deal was that we gave some airplanes to the Forest Service.
Mm-hmm.
So of the 21, we were to get 14 of them. 13 of them were in the air, out in the desert. To the point now, so in the past year plus, so we stood up our asset project offices down in Elizabeth City, where we do most of our aviation work, about a year ago, June. We've regenerated three of those aircraft, and we're flying them right now. We're doing some limited mission with cargo transfers. We're writing pilot curriculum. We're doing pilot training, air crew training, looking at the maintenance philosophy, what the sparing levels need to be, what the maintenance procedure cards are. So ultimately, we're going to take that aircraft and we're going to transition it to an air station out in Sacramento in mm-hmm. about a year from now.
Is preparing and executing a regeneration program the same or similar to as doing a program completely from scratch if you were going to do requirements and all of that for a brand new aircraft program?
So there's a lot of similarities. In some aspects, it's a little harder. In this case, We got a fleet of previously used cars that were sitting out in the parking lot for roughly a year mm-hmm. That we never drove, that we didn't test the drive. We never really understand the maintenance and the oil changes that would happen out there. And so we really didn't understand the conditionings of those aircraft. We kind of got a cold start. We didn't really train our crews to understand that. And so it takes a little time. It's still... In a lot of ways, we got to manage expectations in terms of how quick. I mean, you would think that, hey, they're built, they're sitting out there, they're ready to go. All you got to do is put some gas in and turn the keys. And, you know, a pilot is a pilot is a pilot. And it's not the case.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're learning how to use that. We're understanding what it takes to, say, taxi it down the runway, for example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can only go so fast with it. You can only turn so hard. We got to have those tactics and procedures figured out for the Coast Guard wide.
Mm-hmm.
And all that stuff, I mean, you got to walk in those steps. You got to get the right folks. You got to train at the right pace because these are assets that we expect to have around for a long time. You know, these are instruments of the public, not necessarily just for the Coast Guard. So we got to take care of them.
Considering all of the lead up then that's involved with that, does that wind up being cost efficient and resource efficient in other ways? The time that's involved to get them done and all of that? Or do you fear that you could wind up looking back on this program once these aircraft are all in the air and going, geez, for the amount of time and money that we spent, we might have been able to start from scratch more efficiently?
So I would say that we're going to come out ahead on this. It was, even though the keys were tossed to us at some point, we certainly took some time and did a business case analysis of this based on what we know. So again, with help from our folks on the Hill, They asked some questions, and we certainly took our time to understand that. So in the end, I think we're going to have a cost avoidance of anywhere in the $500 to $600 million cost avoidance in terms of an acquisition cost. That said, we'll go through a process that'll probably cost us about the same to make sure that we set up the logistics systems, that we set up our aviation air stations infrastructure adequately. Mm-hmm. We'll go through a level of training, a level of sparing, and most importantly, that we'll have to go through and we'll have to missionize these things. So again, these are aircraft that was mainly used for cargo hauling around, and perhaps they have some capability that we'll be able to leverage. But the fact that we're going to put them up there to do detection, you know, wide area surveillance, AIS detection, collate them, put them in a common operational picture, to be able to push that back out into our Coast Guard world, so we can do the analyticals analysis on it. That's going to take some time, and mm-hmm. So again, something you would just think you could buy a radar and just bolt it on. Well, you got to look at the structure of the aircraft. Are we going to lose its flight safety, the airworthiness of the aircraft? That just takes some time.
Your surface program portfolio, we've talked about a couple of the elements of that already. We've discussed the offshore patrol cutter, the national security cutter, which you're very familiar with, of course, and the fast response cutter program. What are the other major components there?
Right. So we just completed our response boat medium. It's a 45-foot boat, utility boat, draws about 3 feet. We typically put them out at our small boat stations throughout the country. Very capable. Just finished acquiring 174 of them, a program that started roughly in 2008. And this just past month, we made the run. We completed it all in configuration control, out in the field, doing some great mission in terms of security and life-saving response. That's an aspect of it. We also have some other boats in there, too. So we have a smaller version called RBS, Response Boat Small. We had a version that are out in the field, about 400 of these version 1s out there. They have a 10-year life cycle. At some point, you got to look at them, and they don't last very long. So they're coming up, or they've been at this 10-year life cycle. We're about halfway through the regeneration of the second version of this. And again, the beauty of having it in one project domain is that we're leveraging common processes. So how we oversee what goes on in the yard, how we ship them, how we unpackage them, how we train the folks, very consistent, very understood, very prescriptive, and it's been able to, again, enhance the capability as we roll out.
What's your relationship like in those areas with the Navy and the other parts of the government that build ships for a living to exchange those kinds of best practices and other kinds of information?
Absolutely, very important. We actually do personnel exchanges, if you will, indirectly and indirectly. We hire their folks, and so this has been pretty revealing here in the last year or two. They've been hiring our folks out of there, so that should tell you a signal about it. But a lot of times we like to think in terms of commonality, mm-hmm. right? And we do have conversations, especially with the Navy, quite a bit. We have this National Fleet Board and this National Fleet concept that we're constantly paying attention to because, and again, at the time of war, we definitely need to be interoperable and the Navy needs to be ready for that. But really, the piece that we focus on is the systems and subsystems that go on to our fleets. We leverage the Navy programs of record, especially their weapon systems. And we get in there and we design to whatever they have. And so we are able to leverage their purchases cost-wise, the training, the support, the infrastructure. We leverage their processes as well, the things that we do at our shipyards for oversight. We'll look over there and what they're doing. And again, they recently have looked over at us as well. And so that level of interchange is really, I believe, made both organizations better.
And that's where I was going to go next. It strikes me that that, in your view, would be a healthy exchange of information.
It would be because perspectives matter, right? And we have a different perspective being the Coast Guard. People-wise, we're about 3% of all DOD, but we're included at the table. It's really interesting. The conversation's been dominated by this affordability conversation for a while. I think we all should be paying attention to affordability, but I think we all struggle with how to address it, how to define it, how to pursue it. And that's an area that we've lived with, the Coast Guard, for some time. Our budgets are just not as great. And I feel that we're having these healthy dialogues in terms of what does that mean for the Coast Guard? How are you driving affordability? Even not only just shipbuilding, but even how we handle our C4 systems and stuff like that. So it's just been really interesting.
That's where we go next. The third element of your portfolio is your C4ISR program. We've talked a little bit about cybersecurity already and the importance of how that fits with the other two elements. So with cyber now looked on as embedded into everything that every agency is doing, not just defense agencies, how does that change the way that you maybe look at and think about C4ISR programs as this separate domain by itself?
Right. And we are trying to drive an enterprise view with that one particular domain. Mm-hmm. We do recognize that when we put a cutter, a plane, a helicopter out there, and we write its requirements document, the things that it needs to be able to do, the way it needs to communicate, command and control, sensors oversight, we got to look at it from the asset perspective, because that's how we define it. That's how we scope it. But how do we leverage across the enterprise is a whole nother conversation. So I would tell you 10 years ago when we bought the asset, it was very narrowly defined. Each asset program manager got to decide what the radar was, what the radio was, what the C4 system would buy. And we had this very disparate, uncommon portfolio of things that we had to pay attention to, right? And so now we have this opportunity to like, hey, we're driving through commonality. So the things that we have on a national security cutter, again, scale is a little bit different, look alike what's in the FRC, the fast response cutter. We actually drove some of those things that we had on that from a C4 perspective onto our legacy assets. And as we look at the OPC and we say, hey, we want to leverage what we have as a program of record. That's part of the affordability conversation that we have here. And again, it's going to be a little bit different because it's going to interface different sensors. The scale of it's going to be a little different, but from an enterprise view, it's going to be similar. And so again, from a sustainability, because it Pete's parts, from an information assurance or a cybersecurity perspective, it all looks similar. And so now we can kind of look and manage that from a single viewpoint, again, from, again, multiple or disparate systems. So, I mean, in the long run, we're going to gain a lot of benefit from having this kind of common C4 view for acquisition. And we built upon that over the last 6-8 years.
I imagine there's a training benefit there too. You're training people all in the same, it looks the same to everybody.
Exactly.
As you're training.
So when the individual gets an order from a fast response cutter, again, different scale, gets to a national security cutter, certainly on the OPC, it's not going to be completely foreign.
A couple of other items I saw under the C4ISR domain that I thought were interesting because they're not the big bang stuff that you normally think about when you think about a force like the Coast Guard, the financial management service improvement initiative that you have underway and others. The details are not important, but I just find it interesting that in addition to managing a huge ship program, we've talked about helicopters, a variety of other kinds of equipment, the aircraft program we discussed earlier, you've got the very basic ones and O's underneath your domain as well.
Very interesting indeed. It is got to do those things. Those are stewardship piece. We got to understand what we're spending money on. We got to understand what we're buying. We got to understand what we put in inventory. We have to be able to account for that. We need it to be transparent. We need to be able to do it in a more automated, nimble manner. Those are the kinds of things that government's responsible for. We owe it to the public. And so if that means we need to make an investment, we take those processes that have been good to us in terms of meeting mission capability and we apply it to what we do internally, those things are the same. Again, we go through milestone decisions, we look at capability, we go through a systems service development, we have an understanding of what that is, we get leadership buy-in and advocacy decisions, and we move forward. And those things are very important. One of the things on that list is Rescue 21.
Yes.
That is a very capable system. That's one of the programs I actually cut my teeth on back in the late 90s as an acquisition professional. So for me personally, to see when it was in a pre-acquisition stage, when we're developing the requirements and specification document to engage industry, do the RFP and evaluation, put it on contract and see some of the development. Now to see this thing come full circle, fully deployed through the coastal area of the United States, see it respond to over 80,000 search and rescue cases. We're on our last steps to kind of finish the deployment through the Western rivers up in Alaska. So for a guy that's been around 30 plus years to cut his teeth on a program to see some level of success, because you don't know how things will turn out. You come in for a few years, you move on. It's been an amazing ride.
Speaking of coming in for a few years and moving on, the transition timeline that you laid out at the beginning of our conversation about your predecessor and your successor in your previous position indicates that there'll be a point in time where you transition on to your next assignment. What would you like to be able to look back on and say, I accomplished this or these things as the Assistant Commandant for Acquisition CAO at the Coast Guard?
One of the things we really talked about, mission capability, cost, schedule, performance. But if I look back in the rearview mirror, the thing I want to talk about most is the people.
Mm-hmm.
That has been the thing that's been truly transformational for us. I mean, there has been a time, again, 8 or so years ago where we struggled. We actually gutted the acquisition workforce in the mid-90s. We all shrunk, and that was one of the areas that we took a hit on. And so when we tried to stand up these big programs in the mid-2000s, we just didn't have the workforce. And so initially, we looked on certification process to make sure we had a credentialed program manager. That credentialing program is expanded. We allow logisticians and life cycle cost analysts, business finance guys, contracting officers. I mean, that certification process is now throughout our entire acquisition workforce. It's really risen the tide of our ability to be able to achieve all that. And so if I look at that, I have some initiatives I want to continue to enhance the workforce, to diversify their experience as much as possible, enrich their contributions to everything that we have. So again, it'll make them better. So whatever comes at us next, we'll be able to achieve.
I am going to make a note, because we're out of time today, that the next time you and I get together, we're going to talk about your workforce and what you'd like to do to solidify the abilities and capacity of that workforce. It's great to see you, as always,
Francis,
Joe.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.